something very tragic, almost beautiful. Impoverished middle classes who had this ordinary ritual of going to shop now cannot afford it. So they came there just to do the ritual. They walk around, put stuff in and so on, and they deliver it there, they go. It's a wonderful example how they get enjoyment without pleasure. I don't have time to show you another example, which is the purest for me, and it's terrifying. I hope you saw it, not to be terrorized, not to enjoy it. Joseph Goebbels' Totaler Krieg speech. Took it, you find it in 10 versions at YouTube and so on. And you know what's so surprising? She doesn't promise pleasure, it's just more suffering. Like Goebbels said in almost Kantian terms, do you want a war which will be so total that you cannot even imagine how total it will be? Do you want to suffer so much more that you cannot even imagine how much you will suffer? And this is really, in a terrifying sense, a great speech. Because there is no promise at the end, but at the end you... No, she just promises more suffering. This is enjoyment jouissance at its purest without pleasure. So, okay, let me check it up because... Okay. What I will do is this. If you allow me to go a little bit over, I wanted, before coming to the conclusion, to do another detour through Apocalypse, since we already... And here, I wanted also to refer to my good friend Robert Faller, who is here, how this dimension of enjoyment beyond pleasure is, as a rule, embodied, enacted in all those blind, superfluous rituals and so on that accompany our acts of, as Robert Faller developed this in detail, in one of the most wonderful institutions that I imagine. This is the title of one of his books, Belief with No Believer, with No Bearer. You know, this was always for me the basic miracle of social life. How there are beliefs which can function socially without anyone believing in the first person. Like, allow me to repeat, I hope you don't know it, another wonderful story that really happened in my country in the 70s, ex-Yugoslavia. There was enough toilet paper in the stores. But a rumor started to circulate that there will be a shortage of toilet paper. So, now comes the beauty. What happened? People, in contrast to what we usually assume, did not distrust powers. They accepted it that there is enough toilet paper. But they reasoned in this way. But what if there are some idiots who really think that there is not enough toilet paper? So, to make it sure that they have it, they will start to buy it like crazy. And there really will not be enough toilet paper. To prevent that, it's good for me now to go and buy a lot of toilet paper. So you see the point. Nobody believed that there really is not enough toilet paper. It's enough to presuppose that there is another one who believes in it, and at the end, the result is the same. I will not bore you here with the standard stories of that I like to repeat of this beliefs of like Santa Claus, you know, like ask parents, do you believe in Santa Claus? They say, of course not, I'm not an idiot, I buy the presents. You ask children, do you believe in Santa Claus? Of course not, so why do you act as if, well, not to offend my parents and to get presents? You know, like there are numerous examples of this belief which functions socially, beliefs, without anyone in the first person believing in them. And we can go even a step further. Now, because I know that Robert doesn't quite like Hegel, I will make a Hegelian twist on his theory and introduce here bestimmte negation. I will quote a joke, probably you know it, but I like to repeat it. One of the best jokes in Ninochka, Ernst Lubitsch's film, you know, a guy comes to a cafeteria and says, can I get coffee without cream, please? You know what's the answer, you must know, he gets. Sorry, we don't have cream, so I cannot really give you coffee without cream. But we have milk, so I can give you coffee without milk. You know, this is what Hegel meant with bestimmte negation. You know that although it's materially the same coffee, without, it's not the same coffee, it's without milk or without cream. And from my youth, oh, those were paradise times, not really. Communism, I remember we had exactly the same joke. You, when something was missing, for example, that was the joke, socialist joke. You enter a store and ask, do you already have or do you still not have, let's say, toilet paper? And you know what was the classic answer? Sorry, you are in the wrong store. We are not the we are the store which doesn't have oil. The store which doesn't have toilet paper is the one across the street and so on. So, but now you will think it's just a cheap joke. No, I don't have time to go it, and I hope, Robert, that for this, what we'll add now, I will be a little bit pardoned, not totally liquidated for Hegelian deviation. That I think that ideology mostly lies in this way today. It's not like it brings you coffee without milk, and it claims that it brings you coffee without cream. You know what I mean? It's the implied negation, which is a false one. How does this work? How does ideology function today? Well, I tried to develop it when I wrote a text, not the one in Independent, but the one that I didn't get published. Nobody wants to publish it. This is too crazy. About the French elections. I still think they are the lowest point of our so-called democracy. Why? Okay, we had Le Pen. We know what she is. Proto-fascist, whatever you want. Although I don't like this term, proto-fascist or fascist. Not that she is any better. The problem is that, don't you think that leftists are often quite lazy? They see something they don't like, and instead of thinking what is specifically new here, you simply apply the old term, fascism. You miss the point, I think. But okay, we have Le Pen, we know what she is, danger. Then, who is Macron? He is, it's clear, establishment at its purest. And when I just expressed some doubts in Macron, I was immediately accused of being a slave of fascism, of supporting fascism, and so on and so on. So do you see the absurd situation? How? Okay, I will repeat, you remember the Radio Erevan joke. Let's ask Radio Erevan. Is it true that in France, Emmanuel Macron, independent outsider, united on all the people in a great anti-fascist struggle and so on. Again, in principle it's true, but A, he is not an outsider, but the very inside, and B, he stands, he embodies the very politics which produced Marine Le Pen. He stands for what gives space to phenomena like Le Pen. So, as a guy who hates me very much, he attacked me ferociously, a biographer of Michel Foucault, Didier Eribon. But he provided here a wonderful, he said, the choice is this one. If you vote for Marine Le Pen now, you vote for Marine Le Pen. If you vote for Macron, a vote for Macron is a vote for Marine Le Pen 4 years from now, in the future. That's all I meant, not that I am for Marine Le Pen, but this tragic closure. How, so here, what does this tell of ideology today? Alain Badiou at some point put it in a wonderful way when he wrote that the main function of ideological censorship today is not to crush actual resistance. Repressive apparatuses do that, but to crush hope. To immediately denounce every critical project as opening a path at the end of which there is something like gulag. So I think that that's the crucial thing that happened in France. You know, we had Marine Le Pen for what she is, and we had establishment at its purest. No actual alternative. And the paradox being, if you wanted to move more to the left, you were proclaimed an instrument of the right. That's what centrist liberals like to do today. They claim there is no longer a difference between left and right, just between liberal openness, which means global capitalism the way we have it today, and right-wing populism. So I think that one of the great prospects, this makes me really sad, for Europe is that this standard politics will go on the way it is, which brought us into trouble. Just every 4 years, we will be mobilized to vote for this politics in order to prevent the fascist danger, you know. And then, if you will move to the left, they will say, no, objectively, you serve fascism, and so on and so on. So we are in a very sad situation. I had another long part, but one has to, you know, at least from what I said now, you know what... why people call me Fidel, not because of politics, but, you know, comrades, 5 minutes and then 5 hours, no? So I'm a little bit too long, I admit it. But now, if you ask me a more fundamental question...
Thank you. is new. Maybe the most difficult and creative thing is truly to repeat what was already said. I agree here, and it has great theological consequences with someone that we both like Kierkegaard, and somebody else who maybe we don't both like in the same way, like Gilles Deleuze, who said very nicely that everything really new appears in the form of a repetition. Take the modernity. Who are the idiots of early modernity? Those who simply trusted, oh, new technology, those cheap liberals. But it is Pascal, whose problem was precisely how to remain orthodox in the conditions of modernity, that really generated something new. We read today Pascal, we don't read those cheap apologists. So again, it's my honor to be reduced to your, not even successor, but repetitor, almost in the musical sense, you know, co-repetitor in the opera, and so on. Okay, so again, being an old-fashioned Marxist, I like these westerns from the late 40s, where, you know, the good guys are in white, the bad guys are in black, not too complex. So I like the enemy. The enemy will be personally a friend today. I appreciate him. It will be the representatives of so-called postmodern deconstructive theological turn. Again, I have great respect to them, but I think that's the line that separates us. What defines the so-called postmodern theological turn? Here is a quote from a book co-written by Jack Caputo and Gianni Vattimo. It's the question, how do we get from the post-Christian, post-Holocaust, and largely secular death of God, theologies of the 60s, to the postmodern return of religion? The answer is that the death of God, the secularization of modern Europe, somehow clears the slate by obliterating the moral metaphysical God of ontotheology, and thus paradoxically opens up the space for the new authentic post-metaphysical religion, a Christianity, or maybe not even Christianity, focused on agape. In exemplary of this attitude is John Caputo's On Religion, maybe the ultimate formulation of the Derridean deconstructive messianism. Caputo is horrified at the very idea of a religious dogma, of the notion of a God who decided to address a particular group at a particular moment, according them, a privileged access to absolute truth. But in this way, by Caputo, I think religion is reduced to a belief, to a simple, minimal belief that our miserable reality is not all there is. That the ultimate truth is elsewhere, that there is another world possible, a totally deontological promise, hope of redemption to come, which this hope is betrayed by any ontological positivization. My question, very naive one, what then happens here with, you know, in this post-metaphysical, deconstructive, post-secular, however you call it, thought, where, if I may mock it in a very friendly way, the message is, of course God is dead, there is no grandfather sitting up there, but, and now I'm consciously mocking back, in this void, from this very absence, someone, a voice, is addressing us, an unconditional call, and so on, and so on. My point is, what happens here with the basic Christian motive of the death of God? What is allowed to die in this deconstructive Christianity? As expected, only the temporary, contingent, historic specification of God. A quote from Jack Caputo. So my theology of the event is prepared to concede, if not exactly the death of God, at least the mortality or historical contingency of the name of God, the separability in principle of the event from the name, like a spirit leaving a lifeless body behind. For me, it's difficult to miss the irony of these lines. If you look into Caputo's book, a couple of pages earlier, he violently attacks as supersessionist, potentially racist, the Paulinian idea of opposing spirit and letter. Wait a minute, you're a scientist. Do you believe in this bullshit? Bohr's answer, wonderful one. I'm not stupid, of course I don't believe in it. So why do I have it here? Because I heard that it works even if you don't believe in it. That's our standard religion. Beliefs circulate, you don't have to take them seriously, and so on and so on. The lesson is that we believe much more than we think. So against this kind of cynical relativization, I claim that the only way to redeem the subversive core of Christianity is to return to the death of God theology, to repeat its gesture today. What gets lost in the soft postmodern theology is the dimension indicated by the very name death of God, the traumatic core of the divine kenosis, of God's self-emptying. In postmodern theology, kenosis affects only us, humans. It turns out to be the deconstructive drawing of the line of separation between the unconditional promise and its contingent instantiations. In and through it, the divine dimension is emptied of its ontotheological fetishization. What is missing here, from my perspective, is something on which you insist, all good Hegelian, we insist. It is that kenosis, and this is for me the very core of Christianity. If you take this away, Christianity is another version of paganism. That kenosis is not just a process of us. This is a very Hegelian topic. This is what Hegel meant when he said to grasp the absolute, not only a substance, but a subject. Our alienation from God is at the same time the self-alienation of God himself. What we do with God is what God is doing to himself, which is why, I hope you notice this, in Christianity our access to God is a totally different one than in other religions. It's not God is up there and somehow through some stupid ascetic self-whipping or whatever, somehow you can get closer to the guy. No, what you do is that at the very point when you feel totally emptied, alienated from God, you discover that your identity is with Christ on the cross, which is when God felt abandoned, you know, the famous Father, why have you forsaken me, from himself. It is when you see how, experience how your abandonment by God overlaps by the divine self-abandonment. This means something, among other things, very precise, that although I give a very materialist reading of Holy Spirit, this Holy Spirit does not mean the simple Feuerbachian Marxist point that, oh, okay, we discover there is no substantial God and it's just that God is just a collective ideological projection of us humans and so on, so that all we have to do, you know, this big Feuerbachian Marxist topic, is to reappropriate the alienated substance. No, precisely this double movement of how what we experience as our abandonment from God is the divine kenosis itself. This is the Hegelian core. This tension is, for me, what we need today. And this brings me now really to conclude to what this means for the social order. It means something for the reason of which I think apocalyptic Christianity is still the ultimate horizon today, which we need it more than ever. The idea is a very simple one. This is for me what Christ means with hate your father, mother. Not literally hate them, kill them, but hate them precisely in their symbolic institutional function as mother, father, and so on. The message is a wonderful one. It is that social hierarchic order is not the ultimate reality. There is a space for an egalitarian collective which, as it were, cuts across it. And not just in this Buddhist way of in Nirvana we are all the same. No, no, no. We can be all the same here on this earth. We can organize ourselves as the same here. And again, this universality is not an abstract universality which is wrongly attributed to Hegel in the sense of the universality of a hierarchic order of, you know, like you as a mother are a good mother, he is a good master, you are a good obeying kid, and so we are everyone as their own place. This is for me, are you aware how revolutionary here Christianity is? This is for me the ultimate message. To use the fashionable terms, if there ever was a non-holistic religion, and if there is a thing that I hate is so-called holistic approach, it's Christianity. It's not the religion of to establish harmonious order. It's the religion of struggle, of imbalance. To be universal means to fight. The only true universality is the universality of struggle. Which is why I think, although we should do all possible for the poor people and so on, if you want to understand what Christian love is, you should first understand what it is not. It's not charity. Charity I really hate. As a Christian, although atheist Christian, one of the figures of devil today for me is Starbucks coffee. Why? Did you notice the ideology when you enter it? It's their propaganda. When they all the time, it's the same message. When you buy a cup of our coffee, you don't buy only a cup of coffee. You buy the whole world experience. You know, 2% go to some Guatemala children to educate them for water and so on.
Yeah. La nuit, un jardin endormi, c'est un doux sourire de la vie. C'est un voyage vers l'infini. C'est la valse de Paris dans ce tango de vie. La nuit, un jardin endormi, c'est la tristesse suave d'un éclat de rire. C'est un cœur en éclat de pleurs. La nuit, les larmes de mon cœur arrosent ce jardin endormi. Drôle de nuit. Paris, cette nuit, a mis la lune dans ses cheveux pour une valse d'adieu. Drôle de nuit. La nuit à Paris, un tour de manège, tour Saint-Jacques, c'est le bonheur. Et le bonheur à 10 balles, c'est pas cher. T'as pas 10 balles ?